This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
We're going to talk about technology and the White House. We'll also be playing some special behind-the-scenes Oval Office recordings for you, compliments of the Miller Center. Tomorrow on the program, Ted Genoways. He's the editor at the Virginia Quarterly Review. I should say the award-winning editor at the award-winning Virginia Quarterly Review online at vqronline.org. Ted's just back from Alaska. He's been on assignment, and he'll touch base with us and tell us what he saw about a village in Alaska that's in terrible shape, and they're furiously building homes before the fall season sets in. We're also going to talk tomorrow about one of Thomas Jefferson's unrealized dreams, because frankly, he ran out of money. His botanical garden at the University of Virginia, it was never built, never planted, and yet it was one thing that Jefferson really wanted to see happen at UVA. A graduate student's doing some research about what Jefferson had planned and had in mind. We'll get all the details tomorrow on Charlottesville Right Now. Help me welcome to the program Brian Ballow. He's a historian at the University of Virginia, and he's one of the American history guys. Backstory is the name of the program on public radio stations around the country, and it's produced right here in Charlottesville. And you have a big event coming up with Backstory, right?
Yep, we do. We are going to do a live taping of the show at the Miller Center Forum. It's going to start at 5:30 in the evening, Friday, June 19th. It's open to the public. And I don't know if we'll get as much applause as I just got on your introduction. but we hope that folks show up. And the theme, those who've listened to our show know that we always rip a headline from the newspapers, and then we go back and try to look at the history of that issue.
Give a historical context
exactly.
For modern-day events. Yeah.
And the issue we'll be exploring is looking for work. Pretty timely. We began to take a few phone calls for that show the other day, and we got a caller who said, before I get to my real question, I want to ask, are you guys hiring? So don't show up if you're expecting us to hire you for
a
job. We already have too many historians.
It's not an employment opportunity. It's a wonderful opportunity to talk American history with three of the very best, the Backstory hosts, American History Guys. This, of course, a week from Friday, June 19th, 5:30, at the Miller Center of Public Affairs on Old Ivy Road.
Yep.
Very cool. Well, that should be a lot of fun, and we strongly recommend that folks turn out from that. And that'll be like one of those NPR shows you hear where there's a live audience. Those are always a lot of fun.
That's right. We're really looking forward to it, and you get a chance to look behind the scenes at Backstory and just see how dumb we are before our producers make us sound brilliant.
Good stuff. We're talking with Brian Ballow, historian from the University of Virginia. We're honored to have him back on the program. I have so been looking forward to this conversation, not only because I enjoy having you here and always enjoy talking with you, but we have so many great clips to share with people all the way back to Hoover. And as a matter of fact, that's where we're going to start. So sort of give us an overview of what we're going to talk about today, and then take us back to President Hoover.
Well, Coy, as always, we'll talk about whatever you want to talk about. But I think what you want to talk about is how have presidents and presidential candidates used technology? How long has it taken for them to master it? And how are they, in relative terms, at using it? So we're going to start with kind of the before picture, although it won't be a picture. It'll be a sound picture. And the before picture is Hoover, who really was just very bad on the radio. And so what our listeners are going to hear is a campaign speech. Now, as an historian, I've got to be historically accurate. This was not actually carried live on the radio. This was recorded because all the clips that I had of actually speeches given over the radio are such poor sound quality that your listeners would turn us off.
And
we don't want them to do that. But it will.
Were there many of those?
Yeah.
When radio was just starting out, I guess in the 20s was when it really started to catch on.
It started in the 20s. And the general point we're going to make today is that just because the technology exists does not mean that politicians master it. So radio is around from the 20s. Harding used it. Coolidge used it. Hoover used it, but none of them really got it right. I think your listeners probably know. They're pretty savvy. They probably know who did get it right, and we'll get to that president in a second.
Yeah.
But this is kind of the before sound snapshot, and so we're going to hear Hoover, and what I want our listeners to listen for without driving off the road is kind of the flatness, the way he runs his words together. It really sounds like he's reading from a text rather than actually reaching out and communicating with the listeners out there.
And was that common to Hoover or common to pre-radio presidents?
It was common to politicians who hadn't really figured out this technology. So if we can teach your listeners one thing, it's that just because a technology comes along doesn't mean that, at least in the case of politicians, they've really figured out how best to use it.
Right. So we'll go back now to 1932, a campaign stop. President Hoover, who was the incumbent,
that's right,
running for re-election
under dire circumstances.
Indeed, a little something called the Great Depression, I guess.
First the crash, and then the Great Depression. So, yeah, you would say he's running uphill. If anything, this was a time for trying out experiments, doing anything a little differently to get his message across. But
right.
He didn't get that memo.
So let's hear what Hoover has to say. And he's, in a sense, responding to things that FDR had already said. His proposal for this New Deal for America. And Hoover was sort of setting up the argument that it's not a contest between two men, it's a contest between two very different philosophies of government.
Right. And just because we were going through tough times didn't mean that we should throw out historically our historical way of doing things. That was Hoover's argument.
And let's listen to him make that argument now from 1932, President Hoover.
This campaign is more than a contest between two men. It is more than a contest between two parties. It is a contest between two philosophies of government. We are told by the opposition that we must have a change, that we must have a New Deal. It is not the change that comes from the normal development of national life to which I object or you object, but the proposal to alter the whole foundations of our national life, which have been built through generations of testing and struggle and of principle upon which we have made this nation. Now, my conception of America is a land where men and women may walk in ordered liberty, where they may enjoy the advantages of wealth, not concentrated in the hands of a few, but diffused through opportunity to all, where they may build and safeguard their homes, give to their children the full opportunities of American life, where every man shall be respected in the faith that his conscience and his heart direct him to follow, and where people secure in their liberty shall have leisure and impulse to seek a fuller life.
President Hoover from 1932 in his campaign for re-election, his failed campaign for re-election against FDR. It reminds me of Ross Perot.
Yeah.
You hear a little Ross Perot in that? But I see what you mean. It's just sort of...
Now, just to be clear, we're not arguing that Hoover lost because he was lousy on the radio, but he was no different than most politicians. That was the way people spoke to live audiences, but your listeners hearing that over the radio, I think, will understand how hard it was to distinguish. There's no intonation there. There's a flatness. And most of all, he's speaking at the audience. He simply had not conceptualized the disembodied audience as, you know, real, live human beings, sons, daughters, family members, relatives.
Yeah, really engaging with them.
Really,
and of course,
that
was one of the big complaints of the time of his presidency, that
yes.
He had failed to engage with the nation and wasn't connected with what was really going on in the country.
Right. So folks need to figure this technology out regardless. Hoover just had a personality that was cold, and distant. You know, I've actually written some articles about Hoover, and one of my favorite discoveries in the archives was that when Hoover was running in 28, he didn't want to tell the audience anything personal about himself, nothing. And of course, the 20s were an era of celebrity, movies. Americans were really beginning to identify personally with these figures they, of course, didn't know at all. Lindbergh was perhaps the greatest example. People just identified, they wanted personal details. Well, Hoover just didn't, he would have none of that. So his staff broke into his apartment and stole personal pictures from his hallway and fed them to newspapers. And I have the correspondence where Hoover is very angry about this happening. But, you know, his director of publicity just had to get something personal.
Yeah.
So he was an extreme example. But in fairness to Hoover, nobody of his era really quite got the knack of radio until this next clip I think you're going to play.
Yeah, and this, of course, let's listen to this, the man who first really got it when it came to radio. And this is from 1933.
It is possible that when the banks resume, a very few people who have not recovered from their fear may again begin withdrawals. Let me make it clear to you that the banks will take care of all needs, except, of course, the hysterical demands of hoarders, and it is my belief that hoarding during the past week has become an exceedingly unfashionable pastime in every part of our nation. It needs no prophet to tell you that when the people find that they can get their money, that they can get it when they want it for all legitimate purposes, the phantom of fear will soon be laid. People will again be glad to have their money where it will be safely taken care of and where they can use it conveniently at any time. I can assure you, my friends, that it is safer to keep your money in a reopened bank than it is to keep it under the mattress. The success of our whole national program depends, of course, on the cooperation of the public, on its intelligent support, and its use of a reliable system.
There you go. A personal assurance from the president.
Exactly. Now, Coy, of course, we got to tell our listeners right away that's Franklin D. Roosevelt delivering one of his patented fireside chats. We have to tell him that because you don't want to start a war on the worlds kind of situation where people tune in the middle and in today's post-Watergate era hear the government assuring them their money is safe and immediately create a run on the banks.
Right, right.
You don't want to be blamed for that, do you, Coy?
We're talking with Brian Ballow of the University of Virginia. He's one of the history guys at Backstory. You can hear it on public radio, of course, and they're doing a live taping a week from Friday at the Miller Center. Brian, FDR got it. He understood this is a way to really engage with people. Did he do that before radio? I mean, was he that kind of candidate, or did radio just tap into something in him and turn it on?
I think that FDR was always great one-on-one. He was incredibly convincing, and his style of presidency, of course, was to, in essence, let a thousand flowers bloom, to bring in lots of different advisors, make each one of them feel like they were the most important person in the world, and then step back and decide himself. So he was brilliant one-on-one. What Reagan was too.
Yeah.
What Roosevelt figured out was that this worked on radio too. Rather than giving a speech and having it broadcast, Roosevelt conceived of the medium in a way that allowed him to expand by millions his one-on-one style.
Yeah.
And so he developed these fireside chats, and your listeners might notice that there's, of course, no audience, no audible audience. In fact, he did have audiences. One of my most terrifying times teaching, I was an assistant professor at Harvard University, and I was giving a lecture on Roosevelt and fireside chats, and it happened to be the day that parents came in with their students, you know, visiting day, and this very old man glowering in the background through the whole lecture. I said, any questions? He raises his hand and he said, I knew Roosevelt. I was there when I was a kid. I listened to his fireside chat, and I thought, okay, here it goes. My whole credibility down the tube. He said, and Sonny, you have it exactly right.
So there was an audience there.
There were people there, and I think that helped Roosevelt conceptualize millions he was talking to. But, of course, they were not participating. They weren't cheering. Nobody knew that there was a small audience, intimate. And, in fact, this man had been the son of an intimate of Roosevelt, then used to play in the White House during the fireside chats. So Roosevelt figured out, he got the knack of this technology probably 10, 12 years after it had been popularized, which, you know, then and especially now is a pretty long lag time to figure it out. And I think we'll see that pattern, whatever the medium, if we want to talk about TV or even talk about the internet, that seems to be the pattern. The technology is there first, and then those politicians have to figure it out. And in the case of radio, Roosevelt really got it.
We're talking with Brian Ballow of the University of Virginia. And speaking of television, let's go now to jump ahead a few decades to an example of a very powerful television political campaign ad. And set this up for us. This is the Bear in the Woods, right?
Mm-hmm. This is one of the classic television commercials made in the 1984 campaign by Ronald Reagan. And here the challenge for Reagan is, how does he signal that he's tough on defense without frightening away moderates who might be scared and are being told by the Democrats that, hey, Reagan is going to start World War III with this military buildup.
Which we had gone through before with Goldwater. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. And Ronald Reagan especially and all Republicans remembered that if you're too militaristic, you rattle the saber too loudly, you can really scare a lot of people away. So Reagan wanted to signal that he was tough on defense, that he took the Soviet Union seriously, and the Soviet Union, of course, is the bear.
Right, right.
But he wasn't erratic. He wasn't going to be irresponsible. He was going to be prudent.
Didn't have his finger on the button waiting for you.
He was going to be prudent. He was going to check things out before firing.
Let's hear it. This is the Bear in the Wood ads from 1984.
There is a bear in the woods. For some people, the bear is easy to see. Others don't see it at all. Some people say the bear is tame. Others say it's vicious and dangerous. Since no one can really be sure who's right, isn't it smart to be as strong as the bear? If there is a bear.
I remember that.
Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That was the first election I voted in for president, and I remember that ad. And at the same time, they're running the It's Morning Again in America ad with, I think, the same voiceover guy, right?
Yeah, that voiceover. I wish I don't know who the voiceover guy is. He's great.
Yeah, oh, yeah. And of course, it worked, running against Walter Mondale.
Maybe simply running against Walter Mondale is what anything would have worked. But sorry, I actually like Walter Mondale, so I shouldn't be so.
But your point is well taken.
I shouldn't be
so
catty. And again, we have to remind listeners that we're not saying that this one ad changed the whole campaign, but it is. I'm really glad you played this because this is an ad that many political masters point to as capturing that broad middle, playing to the base, people who are very strong on defense, but not frightening away the very independents and moderates that Reagan was trying to capture. And we can't, we don't have the time to give the before soundscape for television commercials. Your listeners will have to trust me that for the first 10 or 12 years, they were literally cartoons. They were kind of campaign jingles.
Sure, sure.
And then very simplistic, kind of straight-ahead shots of the candidate talking, not unlike the visual equivalents of Herbert Hoover. In fact, they were trying to emulate radio, which had been the most popular medium for campaign advertising.
Early television was, especially in political campaigns, was just radio with a camera.
Exactly. And so once again, it takes a political master, and Ronald Reagan was, to really begin to master this technique. It also was highly produced. I hope that our listeners can't see this commercial in their car while they're driving. But if they could see it, they would see that this had very high production values, very highly produced. And the visuals that go with this voice that they heard is a hunter and a bear, and they're kind of looking at each other, kind of almost sparring with each other. No shots are fired.
Yeah.
But doesn't it make sense to be prepared in case that bear is vicious?
Brian Ballow is a historian at the University of Virginia. He's also with the Miller Center of Public Affairs. We're going to take a break here at the bottom for local news and weather. We're back in just a few minutes. We'll also touch base with Jay James. This is Charlottesville Right Now.
My daddy, I need Radio 1070 WINA Charlottesville. Right now! Right now! Right now! Right now! Right now! Right now!
Try to see it my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on?
82 degrees in Central Virginia on this Wednesday afternoon. I do hope you're doing well. My name is Coy Barefoot. This is Charlottesville Right Now.
Work it out.
Let's rejoin our conversation with Brian Ballow of the University of Virginia and the Miller Center of Public Affairs. He's also one of the hosts on Backstory, one of the American History Guys, and they are doing a live taping of their program a week from Friday. That is June 19th, the summer special. It's 5:30 p.m. at the Miller Center, and anybody can go, Brian.
Anybody can go. It's free, open to the public. And should be fun.
And they can hear themselves clapping on public radio around the country. And you take questions during that too, right? There's a Q&A.
We're going to take questions.
Good stuff. So there you go.
I hope they make them easy.
And, of course, the topic is Looking for Work, A History of Unemployment in America. Let's rejoin our conversation about technology and presidents. And we just heard an example of one of the real key television ads in the Reagan re-election campaign of 1984, The Bear in the Woods. Now let us jump forward again to President Barack Obama, another example of how presidential candidates are learning new ways to take advantage of technology.
Yeah, that's right. When we listen to The Bear in the Woods, that's 84, that's kind of at the very end of the heyday of broadcast television. Even though more and more people were getting their television through cable by the mid-80s, most people were still watching network television. So you wanted to craft ads that would really reach out to as many Americans as possible with one shot and alienate as few as possible with one shot. As we get into the 21st century, we have an example because we can hear it, of targeting a particular constituency that's very much up for grabs, or so it was thought, in the most recent presidential election. And I think our listeners will figure out what population that is when they hear the clip.
Let's hear it. This is a ad for then-presidential candidate Barack Obama.
Compartimos un sueño. Que trabajando duro, tu familia puede triunfar, que si te enfermas tengas un seguro médico, que nuestros hijos puedan recibir una buena educación, sean ricos o pobres. Este es el sueño americano. Te pido tu voto, no solo para mí y los demócratas, sino para mantener ese sueño vivo para ti y para tus hijos.
Soy Barack Obama y yo apruebo este mensaje.
There you go.
Yeah. Now, that's pretty good accent. I'm not a native Spanish speaker, but I grew up in Miami, so I'm almost a native Spanish speaker. Pretty good accent there from Barack. But the point...
That was him speaking Spanish.
Yeah, that's right. But the point we're making here is this might be distributed by radio or by TV, but now we're in a multi-channel era, where channels, if they get 10% or 12% of the viewers or listeners...
That's huge.
That's huge. Yeah. That's gigantic. I mean, this is your business today, Coy, so you know if you can knock off just a small percentage of a certain kind of group. And, of course, you can tell if you... not that you should touch your radio dial, but if you should touch your radio dial, you would encounter a number of Spanish-speaking stations right now. And, of course, they're with the world of hundreds of cable television stations. There are a number of Spanish Univision, Spanish language television stations. So candidates, again, a little bit after these outlets existed, began to figure out, hey, we really need to begin targeting our ads at specific groups.
So they're slow on the uptake, but it eventually does happen, whether it's radio or television or the internet.
And the amazing thing, Coy, is that when it does happen, everybody does it.
Right.
Right? And so the ultimate, which we don't have any clips of, I guess we could have played the Howard Dean scream, but that was the end of a Dean experiment, and that Dean experiment was using social networking to turn out his supporters. He basically took over a website called meetup.com, and he used that for people to connect and actually meet in person. And that was a very important part of his success. He was really getting rolling, and then came the scream.
Right, right.
Well, you know what? Barack Obama picked up where Howard Dean left off and crafted a remarkably sophisticated website that used, you know, Facebook-like social networking, that could tell people events going on in their neighborhood, that could put people in touch with other Obama supporters. And I won't say that it was the key factor in the general election, but it was clearly very useful in the primaries against Hillary Clinton in particular.
Yeah, yeah.
So that places that had very sparse populations, Obama supporters could find each other through this social networking. Again, probably about 8 to 10 years after it was out there, after our kids who are teenagers discovered it, the candidates got into it. Why didn't Hillary Clinton use it as effectively? She was the front runner. And that's the other thing about these technologies. It's often underdogs. It's often the folks that have nothing to lose.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Howard Dean, who experiment and begin to use these new technologies for the first time.
Wow. And, of course, Barack Obama, like FDR, who got radio, Barack Obama got the internet.
He gets
and
it.
This new technology. And, you know, I remember when I interviewed him, there was about 30 to 45 awkward seconds where I was standing in front of the guy while he stared at his BlackBerry and his thumb was working that wheel, you know, and he's pressing buttons and he was just staring at this machine in his hands. And finally he looked up and he said, oh, hey, how are you?
So you're telling me that doing a BlackBerry doesn't make great radio?
And I was also thinking, when you're talking about we're seeing this sort of transition into more niche use of advertising.
Right.
The latest from the world of cable television is that they are going to, they're experimenting now in certain markets, but they are niching ads. So they will know that here's a home with two old people in it. So we're going to give them the ads for this product catered towards old people. And next door to them, during the same television program, they'll get different ads because they have young children.
That's right. Or same concept. They're going to slice and dice ads. So the ad's for a lawnmower, but in the middle of that, you're going to have your local lawnmower store and the owner appear in that ad. All at the same time, but distributed to really target that local connection.
Right. And of course, when you apply this technology, that new technology of being able to really get in there and slice and dice the demographics of advertising, apply that to politics. Just unbelievable what we'll see in our lifetime with all the different kinds of ads in different languages, speaking to different age groups. All, you know, in the same evening on television.
Well, Coy, you know, we could. I actually teach a course called Digitizing America, and I've learned so much. The period covered, and some would say this isn't history, is 1980 to the present. But you want to talk about targeting commercials. In Japan, they now have technology that recognizes pedestrians, sorts them, boy, girl, man, woman, rough age, dress. And depending on what demographic you fit into while you walk by this billboard, you will get a different ad.
Oh, my gosh. That is just amazing.
I'm sure WINA is tapping into that as we speak.
Yes, of course. The elves are busy at work in the basement. We're talking with Brian Ballow of the University of Virginia and the Miller Center of Public Affairs. We're honored to have him live in studio. Let us go next, if we can, to President Nixon.
Yeah, and a very different kind of technology, one that you really wouldn't think about and being in the White House.
So we'll play that, and then we'll talk about it. Let's break it off there so we have more time to talk about it, but stay the hell out of this. Who are we listening to?
Well, we're mainly listening to H.R. Bob Haldeman, President Nixon's top advisor. At the very end, you hear Nixon himself responding. And what they are discussing there is what many would call obstruction of justice. Gray, the man they're referring to, is the head of the FBI, and the Watergate investigation in 1972 is drawing perilously close to the White House itself. And Dean, the dean they refer to is John Dean, and he analyzed the situation and he said, look, the way to stop this is just send the word to the White House, to the FBI director, that he needs to call off this investigation. And of course, the basis for doing that was one of the true nightmares in a liberal democracy like ours, which is hiding behind the excuse of national security. This was supposed to be, they thought the FBI was on to something that might involve the CIA, might involve national security. And so what Haldeman and Dean were suggesting is, let's just use the veil of national security to say to Patrick Gray, look, call your dogs off because, you know,
you're about to undercover
something. You're going to blow our cover.
Yeah.
And when in fact,
they were just trying to cover up Watergate.
They were trying to cover up channeling campaign funds illegally to the White House. So what does this have to do with technology? I thought I'd just throw this in here.
I love it.
because when people think about it, they think TV, they think radio. But here, the simple recording machine, which had existed in the White House since Franklin D. Roosevelt.
No kidding, really?
Yeah, and you know, if you go to the Miller Center of Public Affairs, the presidential recordings program there has transcribed all of these recordings, not all of them yet, they're working on it, but has transcribed recordings going back to Roosevelt. Or if you go to the Miller Center website and you go to the Scripps Library, they've digitized these, and you can listen to these endlessly. I'm kind of at risk for that myself.
Yeah. It's fascinating stuff. I didn't know that Roosevelt had it in the White House.
Well, the reason he had it was he got tired of being misquoted. So without the knowledge of reporters, he had a tape recording machine installed so he could say that, you know, if they got in an argument, he had the evidence. Now, Nixon put it to far more ulterior uses. At any rate, the American public became familiar with this technology in the Watergate hearings, where they discovered this, really one of the many bombshells that came out during Watergate. That was the first time the American public learned about it. It was the first time a lot of staff members learned about this recording device. And
even though it had been in the Oval Office for decades.
Correct.
Interesting.
And without that recorded evidence, it's not clear at all that we would have ever gotten to the bottom of Watergate. Now, today, we can use these tapes to provide a remarkable record of candid conversations by presidents. Now, you have to keep in mind the president knows about this, but often the people he's talking to are particularly on the telephone, starting with Kennedy or Johnson. They started recording these on the telephone, and the person at the other end of the line does not know they're being recorded. For historians like me, this provides a remarkable record of what really goes on. And in an age where we're so distrustful of authority, this is a great way to get insight into what presidents really talk about. And sometimes what they talk about is deadly serious. If we blockade Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis, are we entering World War III?
Right, right.
And sometimes it's, could you cut my pants a little differently so they don't hurt when I'm a little when I'm not following my diet.
Well, let's do this because we've run out of time. But let's have you back in and talk about some of those Oval Office recordings if we can.
We'll
play a bunch for people you can put them in context for us. That'd be a lot of fun.
I would love to do that.
Brian Ballow is with the University of Virginia and the Miller Center of Public Affairs. He's also one of the American History Guys on Backstory. You can hear that on public radio, your public radio stations here in Central Virginia and around the country. And they'll be taping a live program Friday, June 19th at 5:30 at the Miller Center. You can be part of the studio audience Friday, June 19th, 5:30. At the Miller Center. Brian, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Coy.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit seavillepodcast.com for more.